RN, your world unfolding.
Hi there, Paul Barclay with you. Glad you could join me for another Big Ideas here on RN or online or on your pod. Now, I know everyone keeps banging on about the Asian century, but if economic and demographic trends continue, Asia will contribute over half of the world's GDP by 2050. And that could mean profound changes in the global economic and political order. So what are the likely challenges in the Asian region, economic, political and strategic? And how should Australia position itself? The federal government's white paper, Australia in the Asian Century, is due for release, and it will look at how we can maximise the potential of the transformative economic growth and change in Asia. Last month, for Asia Pacific Week, the Australian National University held a forum examining the rise of Asia, focusing on who will lead the Asian century. The forum was moderated by yours truly and was an initiative of ANU students and the College of Asia Pacific Studies. Tonight you'll hear from ANU scholars Dr. Nicholas Farrelly, Research Fellow in the School of International Political and Strategic Studies, Dr. Shiro Armstrong, Research Fellow at the Crawford School of Public Policy and editor of one of the leading policy forums in the Asia Pacific, the East Asia Forum, Dr. Joanne Wallace, Lecturer in Asia Pacific Security at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, and Dr. Asa Doron, Fellow at the ANU School of Culture, History and Language. Let's head to Canberra. Let's start first of all with you, Shiro. To what extent are we witnessing a significant rebalancing of global wealth and power with the rise of Asia? We've talked about this for so long now. Are we witnessing something quite profound here?
Thanks, Paul. Yes, we are. We're already in an Asian century. China, India, already very large economies. China's the second largest economy now, continuing to grow very rapidly on an unprecedented scale. And just behind India, we have, behind China, we have India with a larger population. It's going to continue to grow faster for longer, I think. So we're in an Asian century. Japan, the third largest economy in the world, is in Asia. Right now, after the global financial crisis, we've had the United States, Europe, have a bit of a setback. They've moved to a slower growth trajectory, facing some problems that'll take a while to sort out. And so I think the Asian century is on upon us faster than we could have expected.
And the type of growth we've been seeing is likely to continue, even if in slightly reduced growth rates?
Yes, I think that's fairly reasonable to say. There are obviously some risks, and there'll be some slow down as countries reach that next phase of growth and development, where they can't grow at 10% per year for three decades. It might drop down to 8% or 7.5%, but that's still a doubling of your economy every 7 to 10 years. So it's rapid growth, and it will continue, most likely continue. I think it'll be here for a long time.
Mm. Yeah, Joanne, how do you see it? Is the rise of Asia as massive as many people are predicting at the moment?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. But I think it raises very serious issues for Australia to consider in the coming century, and that's why I'm glad that the white paper's happening. I just hope that some of my concerns are raised in the white paper. Shiro's talked about the rise of the Asian powers. We have to add to that the changing nature of US power and how US power is being rebalanced in the region. And that is going to have quite serious impacts, I think, for Australia's security and for the security of the region as well.
Mm.
So it's definitely something that we need to be paying our serious attention to at the moment.
Nicholas, are we looking mainly at an economic ascendancy when we talk about the rise of Asia, or is there more to it than that?
Certainly, I think there is more to it than that, Paul. What we're seeing now is a shifting of cultural and political weight towards Asia as well. Countries such as Indonesia, Thailand, Burma, Korea, these aren't the ones that we usually think about in the top tier of Asian nations. But there's no doubt in my mind that in the 21st century, these will be countries that will be throwing their weight around a great deal more. Some of them will be working in partnership with the Indias and the Chinas. This will, for a country such as Australia, require all sorts of fancy footwork. Perhaps, as Joanne suggested, some of the decisions have already been made, but there's no doubt in my mind that there'll be further decisions, further pressure points, further opportunities for Australia to recalibrate its positioning as conditions emerge over the years ahead, and this will be a challenge for absolutely everyone.
So we'll see an ascendancy in political power and influence in the region as well with some of these countries. Indonesia, I suppose, the country on our doorstep. Well, we've had a historically sort of interesting relationship. I mean, how do you think that political ascendancy will manifest itself?
I'd anticipate that for those Australians who still labour under the misapprehension that Indonesia is weak, Indonesia is a basket case, Indonesia is anti-democratic, Indonesia doesn't need to be taken seriously, will one day very shortly get quite a serious wake-up. And we're all going to need to be coming to grips with the fact that Indonesia and its leadership will be hoping to shape this region in its own image. Australia will be an important partner in that process, but this is a process that is likely to be led not by the United States or by Australia, but by the Indonesians themselves. They see the Association of Southeast Asian Nations as the key vehicle for doing so, and I'd expect that Australia needs to be working in concert with their priorities if we hope to get the most out of that relationship in the years ahead.
And what about China? When we talk about China and its political power, what are we talking about there? Are we talking about hegemonic leadership by China, or what are we talking about?
I think we're talking about a return to much older patterns. And across the areas of Southeast Asia that at least I study most seriously, the Chinese never really went away. There are large numbers of Chinese, overseas Chinese, as they're sometimes described, who have fanned out across that region over many centuries. They're now being pulled into the Chinese orbit ever more consistently. Chinese migration to countries like Burma and Laos is a really serious issue. I think we need to be considering the Chinese as the most significant power in our neck of the woods for the foreseeable future. This means that the Chinese will call some of the shots, and all of those countries that have close relationships and borders with China are doing whatever they can to make sure they can do this safely and effectively.
Shiro, okay, well...
Okay, thanks. I agree with a lot of what Nick said. The rise of Chinese political power, it's a different political system to what we're used to. As it becomes the largest economy in the world very soon, depending on the projections, but it will become the largest economy in the world, and then by far over a few decades. No doubt its political power will grow, but there's a lag. And so it's how the rest of the region and the United States comes to terms with dealing with this new kid on the block, new big political power in China and India. And I think just getting back to Indonesia and Australia, that's where we can play a role.
Yeah.
So these middle powers, South Korea, Indonesia, Australia, I think that's where we can play a role in facilitating more dialogue, smoother transition, to the extent that we can.
But when you talk about China becoming, Joanne, the world's biggest economic power, political power comes with economic power. And I suppose the nervousness which some people feel is just how will that political power be exercised in our region?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I probably disagree with Nick slightly. I mean, I think we've talked a lot about the rise of China, but we shouldn't write the US off just yet. And there is a difference between economic and political power and military power. And as Shiro has highlighted, there is a lag between the time that you develop your economic power and then the political power and then the military power that follows. And yes, China will be a force to be reckoned with in the region, but we shouldn't write the US off. Equally, we shouldn't write off India and Indonesia and the effect that they're going to have. And I think this is the real crux of the issue for me in this coming, well, this Asian century that we're living in, is that we've been very comfortable for the last 40 years in an Asia Pacific that has been dominated by the US and has had the security guarantee effectively provided by the US, which has allowed all this economic development to happen. Yes, China's rising, but we're going to have to get used to a system where there isn't a leader anymore, where the US is no longer the great power, but nor is China a great enough power to dominate the system either. And I think when we talk about China, we always have to take into account how the US will respond. And I think we shouldn't focus too much. I think China will have an influence, but there will always be a level of US pushback. And I think we should also take into account that a lot of the Southeast Asian states have already indicated their receptiveness to the US becoming more involved in the region, even more than they are. And I think we can see this in the moment with the way the Philippines has been encouraging the US to become involved in the issues that are happening in the South China Sea. So I think we really don't need to write off the US just yet.
Why is that? Why are the Southeast Asian countries encouraging US presence? Is that as a balance against Chinese power in the region?
Yeah, I would perceive it as a hedge against Chinese power for sure. And at the same time, we shouldn't be too hasty to assume that China necessarily wants to exercise its power in the region for any kind of malevolent goals. I mean, everything the Chinese government has been saying and their recent Congress has indicated that China's preoccupations are primarily internal.
Yeah.
They're concerned with regime consolidation, with territorial issues. So I think it's that the Southeast Asian states are looking into the future and seeing that perhaps China in the future might want to exercise its power externally. But for the time being, it does seem to be primarily concerned with internal issues.
Mm.
That's why these Southeast Asian states are just inviting the US in as a preparation for what might come.
Mm. Asa, feel free to come in on this if you want. I was going to come to you on Southeast Asia in just a moment, but I just wanted to stick with China for a little bit longer, because we're asking this question today: who will lead the Asian century? Will China lead the Asian century? And if it does, does that imply a change to the Western style of leadership that the region has been subjected to? Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think we're a bit obsessed with China, unfortunately. And I mean, maybe we're in the Crawford School of Economics and it's all about economy, but as an anthropologist, I want to throw some culture in.
Yeah.
And it seems
we need some culture.
Yeah. It seems to me that what we're missing here, and the elephant in the room, is that China simply is not a democratic country, whereas India is very much at least adhering to the values, aspirations and wants that many people in Australia certainly abide by and see as something to follow suit.
Mm.
And likewise, in terms of India's influence, in terms of the cultures that it disseminate, whether it would be film industry, it's a literary industry. There's many things that I think we can look to India rather to the Chinese economy as the beacon of the Asian century.
Mm.
So I think we need to decenter China a little bit.
Yeah. Yes, China has tended to overshadow the remarkable growth in India, hasn't it? You're correct to make that point that India may be a flawed democracy, but it is a democracy nonetheless. Nicholas, how concerned should we be that the world's largest economic power is likely to be and likely to remain a non-democratic country that will be exerting considerable political influence on our region?
Paul, I think this is a tremendously important issue, and it's an issue that we tend to shy away from when we focus our attention on those remarkable growth figures and everything that goes with it. Anyone who's been to China in recent years appreciates the galloping pace with which Chinese society has been transformed in at least certain aspects. Are they going to be exporting their model of political administration more broadly? Perhaps there'd be those who would, on the Chinese side of the equation, expect that that's a smart way to go. But I reckon they will run into serious pushback all over the world if that was to be their approach. They expect that not everyone would like to embrace that model of political organisation. Certainly in Southeast Asia, there have been so many experiments with democracy now that have taken folk who never had an opportunity to have a say and given them some voice. Efforts to recalibrate political organisation along Chinese lines, I think, would be very dangerous indeed.
Well, contrary to wanting to export that Chinese model, I suppose the flip side of that, Shiro, may well be, is that model going to be sustainable in the long term? It's brought these phenomenal rates of growth now. Will it continue to be able to deliver that in the next decade or two?
Right, that's, I think you're spot on. That's a key question. Yes, the current system is not attractive from where we sit. But we have to remember it's all very dynamic. And as the economy develops, as people become more economically free, political liberalisation is already underway. There are a lot more freedoms than there used to be. Sure, it's not what we recognise as a very representative system. There are forces moving in the right direction. And so I think we can't discount those and look at it statically from where we sit now.
Let's move on to Southeast Asia. ASA, Malaysia, Singapore, much of Southeast Asia, we've seen remarkable stability with the political elites. Not much change for a considerable period of time. Do you expect that to continue in those countries? I mean, we're seeing some change, obviously, in Burma, in Myanmar, a slight liberalisation occurring there. How do you see that happening, playing out?
The South Asian region itself is, you know, the ruling elites, the government, have been very much kind of cemented in their ways. The ruling parties, the military regimes in Pakistan, in Sri Lanka, what we've seen, and other places, except perhaps, again, India is the outlier, where you have a very much vibrant democratic system where there's much more representative government in power, currently in the central government, but also in the states. I think the Southeast Asia question, like you just mentioned, yes, it does show remarkable stability as well as dynamism, but we need to really focus on is the other states in South Asia and to see how are these so-called, some of these so-called failed states will fare in the near future.
Yes, I was talking about stability there, but if you look at Malaysia, North Korea, Thailand, Myanmar, we are seeing significant leadership transitions in those countries over the past few years. Is there an Asian way of leadership in the region?
So I think if you listen to some of Southeast Asia's strongmen, they'd like to convince us that there's an Asian way of leadership and it's their way. I don't think we should take that at face value, though. Certainly Asian leaders tend to conjure up certain cultural resources for purposes that then prove important, especially at transitional moments. And as you noted, Paul, there have been countries all over the region that have had relatively recent leadership transitions. Those are transitions that are seeing new waves of leaders emerge in certain countries. It remains to be seen exactly how they see fit to present themselves internationally. But as the economic weight shifts ever more to Asia, surely there will be confident Asian leaders who will want to insist that their way of doing things needs to be considered an international norm. That would be something quite different for those who've imagined leadership in parliamentary terms, in the terms that have emerged in the United States and Europe in recent centuries. Perhaps the Asian century does give us different kinds of leadership. These are big and as yet untested matters, but it strikes me that this is an important discussion to have.
Shiro, if we were having this conversation 20 years ago about Asian leadership, Japan would have been at the very forefront of the discussion. This is a country that had incredible post-war growth and restructuring. Now it's had two decades of economic stagnation. It's of course got many domestic challenges following the tsunami, the nuclear crisis, the earthquake. What's the position of Japan today?
It's a difficult position, but it's a good question. Japan often gets left out of these discussions. Not because it's not important, it's because it's, for the reasons you mentioned, becoming increasingly inward-looking. And they do have some big problems they're dealing with. Weak political leadership. We're on our sixth prime minister in 6 years. It's amazing. There's a huge
it's
demographic
like the Italians,
crunch.
Really, isn't it?
Right. Well, actually, a nice statistic is since the Democratic Party of Japan came into power 2.5 years ago, the average tenure of a cabinet minister is less than 9 months. Mm. And so talk about leadership. Mm. And so it's got a huge aging population that's shrinking rapidly. Yeah, these are big problems you have to deal with, and a massive government debt. And so these are big problems. On top of all that, throw in a nuclear disaster and a tsunami, and you can't blame the country for not showing proactive leadership in the region. But at the same time, I think it's always important to recognise that things do get done in Japan. Not major reforms, but bureaucracy is strong. It's a very strong society. Things do still move. It's a very prosperous and safe country, so it can't be discounted. It's still a very large economy.
Does the region, I'm interested in how the panel feels about this, does the region need a stronger and more outward-looking Japan?
I'll jump in first.
Yep, sure.
While I'm on a roll.
You have the stage.
I think we really would like to see a return of Japanese leadership. They have a large economy, they have resources, they have technology and capacity to show leadership, and they have in the past. The APEC, Asia Pacific Economic Corporation body, it was crucially Australia and Japan led and created, and that was a public good that both countries provided, and we need that sort of leadership, institutional reform. The Asia Development Bank was a Japan-led initiative. I think it's a crucial time, actually, for Australia, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, these middle powers. Japan can be considered now middle power, if you will, to play a role.
Nicholas?
So if you take the example of Burma's current transition, and if, as I do, you make a habit of reading the Burmese government's mouthpiece newspaper, the New Light of Myanmar, you might know that in the New Light of Myanmar, there are almost daily reports trumpeting the investments, the donations, and all the rest that are coming from Japan to Burma. We might ask ourselves, how is it that the Japanese, at a moment of particular crisis in their own society and economy, are looking to a place like Burma to wield some of their current influence? They're still, I think, quite active on the international scene in all sorts of quiet ways, which wouldn't otherwise be recognised unless we took the time to read The New Light of Myanmar. I commend it to all of you.
But just on that puzzling and disturbing figure of six prime ministers in 6 years, because Umi was in power for a relative stretch of time before that.
6 years, about.
Yeah, so to what do we attribute this, you know, period of political instability?
Well, the simple answer is the electoral system there, and it's difficult to create a majority, and so you have fluid factions and low popularity, low opinion polling, not dissimilar to Australia when you have a minority government. But more interestingly, I think it's these huge problems, and no leader has been able to articulate a strategy.
Yeah.
And so, on top of all the bad ratings, without a big strategy, and because of the fluid factions, there's no ideology between the parties. They're looking very similar between the factions. There's not much difference in policy convictions, so it's open slather and a revolving door of leaders.
Yes. So, okay, as this Asian region gets wealthier and countries economically develop and we see these huge growth rates, what also happens, of course, is that we get economic inequality developing in the region, some countries growing at far faster rates than others, a gap widens. Nicholas, what will happen as a result of that economic gap widening? Can we see on the horizon some tensions developing as a result of it?
I think this is a huge issue for basically every Asian society to deal with. How are they going to manage inequality in the decades ahead? If we were to take the example of Thailand, one of the key drivers of political conflict in Thailand this past half a decade or so has been not absolute poverty, but relative poverty. Poverty based in inequality, perhaps the poverty of envy. There's a pithy line, if you want to understand Thailand's red shirt movement, they are the aggrieved with assets. So they're the ones who've done okay. Maybe they have a motorbike, they've got karaoke at home, they've got the big flat screen TV, they can send their kids to a good school, but they'd actually like more out of life, and they see more in Thai society, they feel like they're missing out on it, and so they want to do something about it, and part of Thailand's recent episodes of political conflict can be explained through that lens.
How does that play out in India? So,
I think it's a very similar case. I mean, the Indian middle class is growing, and it's becoming a major consuming power. And they're unable to get it. But they're unable to get it. I think the source, at least that they attribute, is to the government. There's no infrastructure. There's power cuts constantly. There's no water. There's sewage. These basic amenities that they want to enjoy as participants in the global economy are just not there. And so they are mobilizing around key movements. The latter is the Anhazari movement, which actually championed the whole idea of let's make this government more transparent, let's stop the corruption, let's provide the amenities, the infrastructure that we need in this country. So people are venting, and it's a huge concern.
Joanne, I suppose if you look at the other end of the spectrum in the region, we're talking about these poor countries in the Pacific, some of them states that are struggling to keep it together, the Solomon Islands in recent years. Is there any likelihood, though, that those smaller Pacific island states can benefit from growth in Asia? China, for example, is a reasonably big aid donor, very big aid donor in the region. So could they benefit from the rise of these, you know, the super Asian growth giants?
Yeah, well, the Pacific, I mean, quite a few Pacific Island states have adopted a look north policy where they have specifically chosen to look to China as opposed to their traditional relationships with Australia, New Zealand, and to a lesser extent, the US. China is a large aid donor, as is Japan, incidentally, as well. Chinese aid can have quite perverse consequences in the Pacific. There's no doubt that the money is needed and that there are high levels of poverty, but the fact that a lot of Chinese aid is provided without conditions and in perhaps less than transparent circumstances means that it can fuel corruption and patronage, which can have quite negative consequences for democracy. So, yes, you know, trade and investment from China is a positive thing, but at the same time, their aid program can have quite negative effects.
Joanne Wallace from the ANU's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, talking there about the future leadership in Asia, together with Nicholas Farrelly of the School of International Political and Strategic Studies, Shiro Armstrong from the Crawford School of Public Policy, and Asa Doron from the School of Culture, History and Language. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational, where you can post your thoughts on Australia's role in the Asian century. Remember, Big Ideas podcasts are available when you are. You can even download them before broadcast. And you can follow us on Twitter at @RNBigIdeas. Get involved in the big ideas. Today we're at the Australian National University, the ANU. If the Asian century is upon us, what is Australia's part in it? Back to Canberra.
Shiro, what scope is there in this rapidly changing Asian region for Australia's role? I mean, how will our role change? Is it likely to be mainly an economic role, or should we and can we play a major political leadership role in the region?
Well, we have to be pretty careful, I suppose, not to overstate the role we can play politically. Economically, I think we're already playing a major role. We're a secure and stable energy supplier to a lot of Asia, Northeast Asia. We're the single largest source of raw materials to China, Japan. And so we're helping fuel their growth. And so we are important to these Asian countries, and keeping our supply secure and open to them is important. As for the role we can play politically, I think we're not going to be able to do anything alone. That's a good starting point. We're going to have to continue to create, reform and shape institutions in the region and globally, so that we can facilitate more dialogue, cooperation and understanding, I think, between these big powers.
Do Asian nations, in fact, want Australia to have broader engagement in the Asian region? Nicholas, your thoughts on that?
Thanks, Paul. Certainly, there's an appetite out there for Australia to remain a partner in regional fora, to continue to be a broker in various region-wide arrangements, but we need to temper our ambitions. This will be a region that is determined by the jousting of major players, and Australia in the foreseeable future will have no role at the very highest tables. Perhaps at the second tier, though, Australia can play a very productive role. We can be a moderating influence. Perhaps we can encourage those countries that are unsure about the virtues of a more democratic system, that actually they'll benefit from embracing the institutions of a free media and more open political participation. This is something that Australia can, in very quiet ways, perhaps insist would be in everybody's best interests, but we need to go about it with utter respect and humility, and at least under some circumstances that doesn't come naturally to all Australians.
Yeah, yeah, that's an understatement. Joanne, how well prepared is Australia for intensifying that engagement and those relationships? Do we have a clue, frankly?
I wish we did, but I don't think we really do.
President Company excluded, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard when you're at the ANU. You can get quite a biased view because, of course, we're all in the College of Asia and Pacific. We're occupied with Asia and the Pacific. But in wider Australian society and at the level of the government, I don't think the government has really come to terms with the fact that they are living in an Asian century, that the power structure is changing, and that Australia's reality is going to have to change with it. And I think a large part of that, I would agree with what Nick said, and I think we need a huge dose of modesty in our approach to the region. And we also need to get to know the region a lot more. And I mean, my colleague Hugh White in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre has put forward this proposal that Australia send a lot more students to Indonesia and to other Asian countries to learn the language, to familiarise ourselves with the culture, and then for also vice versa for those Asian countries to get to know us. And I think that would have a lot of legs and would be a good first step in that regard.
We saw this play out with India, didn't we, Asa, recently, the attacks on Indian students in Melbourne, and it was big news in India, and they weren't impressed, really, with how it was handled in Australia.
To put it mildly. I did some field work about my current project on the mobile phones in India, and I went to interview someone who repairs mobile phones on the street. You know, they kind of tweak the mobiles and repair them, and he asked me where I'm from, and I said, from Australia. He said, I'm not talking to you.
Really?
Simply like that. I mean, just at the level that the Indian media has taken this to, I don't think that it's all justified, but what I'm trying to say is that it really perforated down to the lowest common denominators. And the kind of view that Indians have of Australia is really, really gone down. Mm. And that's very unfortunate. And again, I agree with what's been said here. I think, you know, ANU, we're in a position that we're really trying to kind of lead the study of Asia. And there's really a productive and important efforts to try and boost Asia and South Asia. But you don't see that in Australia by and large. And language is remarkably important. I mean, Australia needs to wake up that, for example, in India, only a minuscule amount of people speak English.
Yeah.
We all think they do, but they don't. And there's dozens of languages there. So it's incumbent, I think, upon Australia, if we want to engage with Asia more, and rather than be seen as an outpost of British colony or somewhere.
Whose responsibility is it to ensure that we are genuinely engaging? Is this the responsibility chiefly of the government, or is it all of our responsibility, the responsibility of citizens in Australia as a part of Asia, the business community? Nicholas?
Hey, of course, it's got to be everybody's responsibility to take the Asian century seriously. It's in every individual Australian's personal and private interest to do so, but I don't actually imagine that the transformative investments that are required, the changes to national ideology and all the rest, will come from some groundswell of support. In fact, that's very unlikely. It requires leadership, and it requires leaders who are prepared to put something on the line, perhaps take a few risks, perhaps be in a position where they might be vulnerable to getting burned. The sorts of engagement that Joanne just flagged, channeling Hugh White's proposal, is exactly what Australia will need to accept in the decades ahead. It will be expensive. Mm. Things will likely go wrong. But over the long term, there will be incremental changes to Australian society which will better us all, and I don't see any alternative to that.
What type of changes? What are you talking... How could we be influenced?
So if you were to to go out on the streets in Canberra or anywhere around Australia this afternoon, I think you'd find that there's a fair amount of superficial affection for elements of Asian societies and cultures. We all delight in eating our pad thai. Australian restaurants of Chinese derivation have been a fixture of every Australian country town for at least two generations. Everybody's pretty comfortable at that level, but it's the deep stuff. It's the politics, the history, the culture. Yeah. How do you do business effectively? This is the hard stuff. It'll take time, it'll take money, it'll take a lot of effort.
But Joanne, it's clear that Australia is benefiting enormously economically from growth in Asia. Do we therefore have a responsibility to dig deeper, to reciprocate those economic benefits with making a considerably larger effort at engaging and understanding the region?
Yeah, and look, I think a really simple thing to do would be for our political leaders to change their rhetoric. I mean, harping on about boat people and the threat of asylum seekers, I mean, that dominates our relationship with Indonesia. Yet there's so many more important and deep issues that we should be addressing with Indonesia. We have an Indonesian leadership at the moment that is perhaps the most receptive to Australian contact and Australian overtures that has ever seen. Yet we harp on about boat people and we harp on about the live export of beef. These are quite side minor issues that are being played out for domestic political gains, but they're not having any sort of long-term calculation about what this will mean for our role in the region.
Mm. Okay, if we can turn to have a look at the internal politics in some of the countries in the region. And Asar, I'll come to you again on India. We do continue to see mass movements rising from amongst the disenfranchised in India, indeed throughout the Asia Pacific, specifically protests against corruption, for example, in India. What does this tell us, and how much influence can those grassroots campaigns have on the entrenched political structures in a country like India?
That's a good question. There's a guy who was one of the founding leaders of the untouchable caste in India, in Uttar Pradesh, in North India. His name was Kanshiram. And when people interviewed him on TV, he used to say that as untouchables, we occupy this side in numbers of the pen. The others are the upper castes. My aim is to turn the pen upside down.
Yeah.
And what he did was remarkable. And he did that because UP, Uttar Pradesh, the sixth largest populated state in the world, has been ruled for some years now, recently by other backward castes, by a Dalit untouchable-based party headed by a woman called Mayawati, who is untouchable herself. And he himself was very much part of that engine that spearheaded this movement for the Dalit rise in Uttar Pradesh. And he did so with basic communication means. He used to go on the bicycles from village to village, on the train, and stop on trains and make rallies and increase the consciousness of these oppressed, untouchable castes, that they too have a voice and they have the numbers.
Mm.
And then comes Mayawati, his student, and she says, okay, let's use another communication technology, the mobile phones. Now, because in India, you're not human if you don't have a mobile phones. Everyone has a mobile phone, right? And they began to mobilize these oppressed, these people were feeling caste prejudice on a daily basis, and mobilizing these people across mobile phones. It wasn't the instrument that won the election, but it enabled the mobilization of these people in 2007 to win the elections. Similarly, with the recent ones, the OBC, the backward class, by Akhilesh Yadav, again, another remarkable movement of people who are not upper caste who are able to turn the tables around.
So real opportunities then for those grassroots movements because of their sheer numbers. Let's look at another country closer to home, Joanne, the newest country in the region, Timor-Leste. What's been happening there? We've seen a bit of a surprise with the presidential elections. How is politics playing out in East Timor at the moment?
Yeah, well, that was just the parliamentary elections just happened this weekend, and the results are now shaking out, and with that, the coalition building that will be necessary to form a government in Timor. I think that the elections, both the presidential and the parliamentary, are very promising for Timor-Leste's future. They were both relatively peaceful. It shows the success and maturity, I'd say, of Timor-Leste's democracy. There are interesting things afoot in Timor-Leste in terms of their negotiations with the Australian mining companies over the Timor Gap. But by and large, I think Timor-Leste and the Pacific Islands more generally are doing relatively well. It's sometimes quite aggravating if you work in the Pacific Islands. They do get quite a negative press in Australia, but if you look at what's happened in the last 5 to 10 years, I think that we should be relatively positive about what's happening in Timor and in the Pacific Islands.
They're moving into a new phase. Some of the old faces that we've associated with the East Timorese independence movement have moved off the stage. Are we seeing a maturing of politics, perhaps, in East Timor?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we have to keep in mind that the Timorese people had lived under occupation for 24 years and had very little experience of democracy when they gained their independence in 2002. When you consider that Timor-Leste is only 10 years old, it's amazing how far it's come. I mean, yes, there are challenges, and the primary challenge is how to achieve even development. Mm. You know, Timor-Leste has very high economic growth, but that tends to be focused in Dili and does not trickle out to the rural areas. But considering that the country is only 10 years old, I think we should be very encouraged by what's going on there.
That is a very encouraging take, because we do often hear talk about that part of the region very much in the context of failed states, that these countries don't have a sufficient economic base, their political structures are somewhat shaky. How do you see the prospect of sort of destabilisation, anarchic political systems emerging in some of these countries? We had to come and play a role in the Solomon Islands recently, the Australians. How are you seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, the Solomon Islands intervention was in 2003, so, you know, a long time has passed since then, and Solomon Islands is relatively stable now. I mean, Papua New Guinea would be the obvious place that we would look to, and that the press loves to report stories of cannibalistic killings and horrible things going on in Papua New Guinea, but they only represent a very small fragment of what is going on. And we have to keep in mind that in places like Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, that grassroots political organisation is very strong, and that people can live in these places relatively untouched by the state. So people do go about their everyday lives, and they're getting on with life. They're very pragmatic. They have their own social and cultural orders. What goes on in the capital city is actually a very small fragment of what actually happens in people's lives. So when we hear about the political machinations in Port Moresby, for example, that's not actually affecting a lot of Papua New Guineans who are just getting on with their lives. So I think when we talk about failed states, we're talking about failed institutions, but they're not failed societies. And I think we need to look at the strength of these societies when we look at the region. And if we do, I think that offers a lot more optimism for what can happen there in the future.
Mm. This issue of Asian languages, you know, we've seen such enormous change in our understanding of Australia being a part of Asia. We've seen enormous growth in the economies and the presence of Asian countries. Yet, Nicholas, we haven't seen really anything near the uptake in Asian language study that you would think would occur at the same time. I mean, is this, why not? Is this a lack of leadership? Or because I mean, I was at high school, as you can tell, a very long time ago, and Indonesian was offered when I was back at high school. My son studies Japanese today, but still we don't see the penetration.
Oh, we don't, Paul. We've tended to have very modest ambitions when it comes to language learning in Australia, full stop, and that's reflected in how we go about learning Asian languages. We do so in piecemeal fashion. We do so very inconsistently. We don't consider fluency in an Asian language to be good preparation for anything, except for perhaps sitting on a panel like this and offering your thoughts on the Asian century. In fact, if you went into most boardrooms in Australia, you'd struggle to find a serious speaker of an Asian language who is not from Asia themselves. The same goes in many schools, many government departments. Decision makers in Australia don't themselves tend to have all that much direct experience of Asia from a young age. And that's what really counts. Like you, Paul, I studied Indonesian at school. It was, for me, a very formative experience. And I appreciate the fact that my school would offer it to such a very small number of students. And they would beg, borrow and steal resources to ensure that there was a functioning Indonesian language program. If you were to explain this in the context of European education, the average European would find this ludicrous, that Australia has remained willfully ignorant of its behemoth neighbour. This is something that could be changed, but I'd expect that, say, in my lifetime, it may only be in my waning years that we will actually see Australia and Australians fully get to grips with this.
Look, I should actually say, I should clarify, that although Indonesian was offered when I was at high school, I did French. Not very well, either. But we haven't clearly gone very far in the last 30 years or so. And there's this television show doing the rounds at the moment, Asa. What is it? Dumb, Drunk and Racist. And it is about how Indians perceive Australians. And you were talking about this earlier, about trying to have a conversation with somebody in India, and there's a lot of bridge building that needs to be done. And do you think it needs to be from a position of genuine engagement, learning languages, really, really, really understanding these countries that we're talking about?
And not only understanding, those countries are not homogenous by any means.
Yeah.
I mean, just back to your French, yeah, for a second. Because exactly, that's the look west that Australia has. It's almost in its fiber. I mean, the idea that India is a homogenous entity is flawed. There's many states in India. Actually, the states command more power than the central government at the moment. If you want to do any business in India, you need to go to the state capitals rather than New Delhi. New Delhi is jammed. There's corruption. It's really in a block. So not only understanding India as such, but also understanding the variety that India encompasses, and not simply in terms of the Bollywood, cricket, and all these kind of benign aspects of it, but rather understanding the political economy, the politics of India, and the geography of the place itself.
Mm.
It seems to me like it's ridiculous that only 1.5 universities in Australia offer an Indian language, which is Hindi and Urdu. Mm. And, we're lucky that at ANU it's still preserved, but this is 1.2 billion people.
Yeah. I suppose that one of the things we haven't talked about in terms of relationship building in the region is what they call the regional architecture, essentially the important regional institutional structures. Shiro, how do you see ASEAN as being a giant of the region in terms of an institutional structure in the region? There's the East Asia Summit. Are those regional structures going to be able to carry us forward into the next phase of the Asian century?
Well, you've forgotten also APEC, which is very important.
Yes.
ASEAN, we have the ASEAN Regional Forum. So we have these fora, these frameworks in the region. They've served us well, especially the economic ones. It's a very diverse region, different systems of government, different levels of development, and amazing shares of trade and investment between them. So economic cooperation, we've done extremely well. By some measures, we're further ahead, further economically integrated than Europe, in fact. But politically, I think that's where we need a lot of institutional reform in these bodies, some more coordination between them. And something that hasn't come up today yet is the G20, the group of 20 largest countries in the world, largest economic powers in the world. And Asia has six members in the G20. And so I think it's important to start connecting some of these regional discussions to the global level. A lot of what Asia is experiencing, a lot of the impact that Asia's having, is a global phenomenon, not just a regional one. So there's a lot of work to do, and the politics and the strategic side of these forums have not been developed fully yet. But I think that's where we need to start putting a lot of thinking and innovation into.
Our former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd proposed the Asia-Pacific Community concept. This was dismissed by Prime Minister Julia Gillard. Was he onto something? Will there ever be an Asia-Pacific Community? I'm happy to throw this one open to the panel as well. Asa, have you got any thoughts on that?
Initially there was, at least from the Indian perspective. I mean, you have all the nationalists under colonial rule who were kind of envisioning this Asian civilization that India can promote, pan-Asian unity. You had Nehru, you had Tagore, you had other foundational figures. And then Nehru in 1947, March, April, convened this big conference all about promoting pan-Asian unity.
Mm.
But unfortunately, once they got independence, realpolitik collided, and we haven't seen that. I don't think India is particularly engaged in this sense, and these lofty ideals of a pan-Asian community, I think, are kind of being diminished.
Nicholas?
I think in the Asian region, we just need to accept that nationalism is, at the present moment, just about the most potent organising force. And while that remains the case, we probably need to think pretty carefully before we put too much of the emphasis on the supranational institutions, at least in Southeast Asia. While there are many who are very proud of ASEAN and its achievements, there are at least 10 times as many who disparage its outcomes, who consider it merely an English language talk shop for regional elites so that their wives can go shopping and the boys can play golf. It sounds harsh, but there is something of that whiff still about the way that these top-level regional fora operate. And for there to be more genuine regionalism, I think we do need to get past that pattern and have links at all sorts of other levels too, perhaps within ASEAN. After 2015, when the ASEAN community is in place, there'll be some opportunities to see how those lower level links will further enmesh things, and that may make ASEAN, as one example, that much more palatable to the region's people.
Yeah, I know that the comparison with the EU is not a terribly useful one. However, this is a group of countries that transcended their own nationalist interests to come under one banner in the interests of a region. We're not seeing anything like that in Asia at the moment. Is that a concern, that we're seeing a more intensified nationalism at a time when this region is growing?
It's intriguing to consider this Europe-Asia comparison a bit more fully, precisely because the European experience required the furnace of two world wars and all of the hardships and tragedies that went with them to finally catalyse something like what we see today. That is a very, very heavy price to pay before everyone's been able to get along together. In Asia, I'm sure we all hope that such a price will never need to be paid, and it's up to those in a position to steward these regional integration efforts to do their best, but I wouldn't pretend it's easy. I think it's actually quite an unenviable task.
Just on that, I think it's important to still recognise, I'm a little bit more optimistic than Nick on the institutions we have in Asia. It's a very different form of community building. In the EU, there's much more similarity in types of government, in levels of development, and so it was easier in a sense to have these, and there was the history that made it easier to have these binding, legally binding and enforceable agreements between countries and coming into a union. In Asia it's been very different because of the diversity, and so I think these talk shops, ASEAN, they get a bad rap, but they do play a role in constraining the nationalism at some levels. They do promote a whole lot of understanding between countries, especially in the economic field. And I think that's where we need to focus our energies and to make sure that we can talk about the politics without it being the zero-sum type game where one country has to lose for the other to benefit, but in the positive-sum economic sphere where it's actually served the region very well to this date.
Dr. Shiro Armstrong there, Research Fellow in International Development Economics at the Crawford School of Public Policy. You've been listening to a discussion on who will lead the Asian century conducted last month during ANU's Asia Pacific Week. Your other guests were Dr. Nicholas Farrelly, Research Fellow in the School of International Political and Strategic Studies, Dr. Joanne Wallace, lecturer and convener of the Bachelor of Asia-Pacific Security at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, and Dr. Asa Doron, fellow at the ANU School of Culture, History and Language. Thanks to the ANU and to the staff at the Crawford School of Public Policy for all of their assistance with tonight's program.